turn this on and I'll be 60 years old this year, so I, you know, everybody from certainly from my generation on is indebted to Barney. You know, it's hard to believe that it wasn't so long ago where D.H. Lawrence was banned in this country. Yeah, I mean, I can understand the English banning it. After all, he was a commoner with a lady, you know. But Barney brought that about. Henry Miller, Marquis de Sade, Beckett. I mean, how many people? How many people did Barney not only publish, but make their publication possible by other publishing houses?
Sure.
You know, I mean, sure. He opened up a whole new thing that nobody thought of. Plus, a lot of those reprints, those public domain things that he kept, that nobody, you know.
A lot of classic American literature.
Yeah, people were putting them down because, oh, look at this reprint stuff, but he made it available. I mean, you know, it was terrific. I mean, just absolutely terrific.
Can we talk about, can we start where you start with Barney? Your own writing career, and how you and your work get to Barney and Grove. Were you feeling some of that historical?
Yeah, background? Well, I started writing, and naturally I started hanging out with other writers and so forth. The main individual in my life has been Gil Sorrentino. We come from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn. We went to the same school, PS 102. We didn't know each other then, but when I got out of the hospital around 49, 50, we started hanging out with each other in neighborhood bars. And I used to listen to Gil and other people talking about writers. I had read a book, I didn't know from nothing. And I hear him talking about Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, all these names. And I try and remember as many as I could. The next day I'd sneak over to the library, make sure nobody saw me. I'd sneak over to the library. And I'd start reading these guys. And then eventually I started to write. And by that time, Gil had gotten in touch with the old Black Mountain people, Joel Oppenheimer, Robert Creeley, and all that. And we all started hanging out. And then we started a little magazine called Neon. And we put out a few issues of that. And that's become a sort of a classic. You know, in those days, there weren't many little magazines around. Mm. And so we started a few. Leroy Jones started Eugen, and we all kind of worked together on these things.
Well, this is all in Brooklyn, essentially? Or
well, no, Brooklyn and then the Village.
The Village, yeah.
You know, we kind of back and forth.
Right. Well, what period is this now?
Let me see. That's a good question. This is second half of the 50s by now. We start in the early 50s and first started hanging out with him. And then when I started writing around 58, no, before then, 54 or something like that, I don't know, 55, whenever I started right around 55, 56, and I'd go over everything I wrote with Gil. He'd read it, we'd go over it. Sometimes we'd spend an hour on a word. You know, why this, why that. That's one of the reasons I can tell you exactly why every syllable is where it is, every piece of punctuation is where it is. I mean, every fucking little letter. And I just kept writing. We all just kept hanging out together. And then eventually every weekend we'd spend over at Leroy Jones' house because she always had a big apartment. And then people were reading my stuff and they liked it.
Did any of it in print yet?
No.
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 So it's all manuscript.
Yeah, we just, you know, sit around and talk, and we read each other's things and take it home, and, you know, that kind of stuff. Nothing formal, totally informal, but just the kind of thing you do. And a lot of people liked it. And they wanted to help me get it published. Somebody gave something to the Provincetown Review. They gave me a tralala. I can't remember the guy's name now who was doing it. Put it out. And anyway, I had most of Last Exit written. And I think it was Seymour Krim. Had some friends at some publishing house and suggested that they look at it. So I sent them a copy of what I had. And we got together for lunch. And it was two editors and myself. And what they wanted me to do was sign a contract and agree to write a novel And they would publish the novel, and then they would publish this book, because they said, you know, books like this don't sell, and so forth. So it's the way we have to do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that would be. And I was in the bar that night, the Cedar Street bar, you probably know that. And Roy was there, Leroy Jones. And I was telling him what had happened that afternoon at lunch, and he said, well, why don't you get an agent? I said, man, I don't know agents. As I said, I've never tried to get anything published. I just wrote. So he said, well, Sterling Lord is Jack's agent, Jack Kerouac. So why don't you try him? I said, all right. So anyway, I called him, and I ended up going up there with the manuscript, and I left it with him. And then a few days later, I went up back to his office, and he said, I read your book, and I think we can make money together. And I like that. You know, none of this, I know what it is to be an artist. I don't know what fuck all. I mean, you're an agent. What kind of shit? So anyway, he sent it to Grove, and Barney accepted it. It was a while before it got published. That was one of the problems with Barney. Barney, I guess, maybe Barney was locked between his desires and dreams and the pragmatics of publishing. I don't know, but he always wanted to do anything, but it would take him a while to get it, you know? So it was a while before it actually got published, but what they did, as I understand it, I'm not certain about this, but by that point, Gil was working at Grove. By the time the book was actually published, he was an editor, or assistant editor at Grove. And he had written like a definitive analysis critique of the book, because he had been reading it from the inception. And what, as I understand it, what they did at Grove, they sent a copy of Gill's critique, or whatever you call it, guide to reading it, along with the review copies to, you know, everybody they send it out to in the beginning, which was, I think, like a stroke of genius, because, you see, I don't think of The Last Takers as being a strange book. I don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because never having gone to school, I didn't know you're not supposed to do that. I had read people like Celine and Genet, and I didn't know you're not supposed to do that. They did it. There's nothing new here. Homer did it. Nothing new as far as I can tell. Just the names were changed. So, it gave a lot of these timid reviewers something to work for. It gave them a point of reference and a foundation. Because I noticed that some of them, and one in particular I'm thinking of, was afraid to take, was afraid to say, yeah, this is great or this is shit. Just really afraid to take a stand. And, but then there were people like Webster Schott who perhaps wouldn't have needed it, but I think it helped. I think it was a great help. And there were some really outstanding reviews. And then what happened, again, this is my understanding of it, which is really very amusing. Time magazine reviewed it and called it Grove's Dirty Book of the Month. They, like, really attacked the book, which is nice. They gave it a lot of space.
Sure.
And so, you know, a lot of people don't like Time, so they didn't like it. And Newsweek, I guess, might be considered a competitor. And the fellow there liked Last Exit, so they gave me a big spread in Newsweek, a review interview kind of thing. And then there was an interview in the Saturday Review. And that's so, and it just, so it was used by some people to attack Time magazine.
Sure.
So it became a big thing. And then Barney took out this big full-page ad in the Times. You know, the Daily Times, a big ad, the whole full page. And I remember they had a big caps. They had a quote from Allen Ginsberg. And it was something like, this book should explode like a rusty bombshell over America. What of Allen's thing,
great,
you know? And that certainly didn't do any harm.
Sure.
Then I had a whole bunch of quotes from other people. And they really pushed it. As I understand it, what's his name? Nat Sobel, I think, was the head of the sales department at the time. I understand they sold out the first edition before publication date. And, I mean, they really got together and did a job.
How big was that first run, do you remember?
I have no idea. I don't know, maybe it was 6,000 or something? I don't know. I guess it was the usual thing, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, I got, and then from there, of course, it kind of took off. Then, of course, there was debate in the House of Parliament in England, which is a whole other thing. But everything kind of conspired with Grove. All the forces there at Grove seem to conspire for the success of the book. And it seems like, as far as I can tell, not knowing the business aspect of it, but as far as I can tell from what I've heard, is that like, they took full advantage of it. They didn't just sit back and see if the book would sell itself and then take out a little ad someplace. I mean, they really went all out with the book. And so it still sells all these years later. That was 1964 when it was published. So Grove, you know, like really took a chance, I guess.
Was any of it published in Evergreen, or...?
Tralala was published in the Provincetown Review, and they had a court case over that one, too, which was thrown out on appeal.
That is, the Review had a court case,
yeah.
not with the press, but with someone who tried to censor the Review.
They up in Provincetown, the local court, arrested the editor. I forgot his name now. For selling pornographic literature to a minor. And it turned out the minor wasn't a minor, he was 19 years old, it was all something I set up. And the thing was so flagrantly illegal that after he was found guilty in the lower court, the state attorney threw it out because of shit. And then they printed the whole transcript of the trial. So that was in them, but I wasn't Evergreen. It seems to me that something was in Evergreen, but there was something in the Black Mountain Review part of it. I don't know what the hell it could have been. Was in the Evergreen Review.
No, I can easily look at that. I checked for the first.
When did Evergreen Review first come out?
Really, pretty early. By 59, 58,
oh, okay,
59.
Then it was out.
It was around for...
Oh, that's right, it was in that small format thing.
Right,
I remember. Jesus, I don't, seems to me that somebody said there was, or I remember seeing in the front of one of my books that something was on there.
But as far as you recall, just the Provincetown Review and the
Black Mountain Review. Yeah, I can't think offhand what the hell it could have been. That was an Evergreen. Unless Baby Makes Three.
I can easily check that.
Beats me what it could have been.
But essentially, this manuscript was presented to Barney, finished, and not very much changed between that time and its publication.
No change at all. That was part of the contract, and that's always part of my contract. I can't change anything. They make suggestions, and most of the time I'll take like at least 90% of the suggestions. I don't want somebody arbitrarily correcting spelling and things like that.
Sure. And so you worked primarily at Grove with Sorrentino?
It was a young lady, I can't remember her name. She was fantastic. She edited this manuscript. She was marvelous. And she made some suggestions that were right on and caught things that you just can't see.
Sure.
I mean, the whole thing was just, God, it was like all the gods got together. You know, really, the people were so wonderful. Really wonderful.
Now, during this period, did you have much contact with Barney?
No, never. I think I saw him once at some kind of a thing in the Judson Church. I think I met him once, but I wouldn't recognize him.
And where did you go from there, from Last Exit?
Well, the next book was quite a while later. I stayed drunk for about 6 years. And then I wrote The Room out here. And that was really a great experience for me because I realized my debt to Grove Press in an indirect way. I had gotten totally screwed up with booze and drugs. And didn't even file an income tax thing. I just totally screwed up. And I finally got sober, and I got back to writing. I guess this was the end of around, yeah, just around the end of 1969, the beginning of 1970, I started writing. And it took me 6 months to write the book. And by then I was involved with the IRS. I had gone down to the IRS and told them that I owed them some money. Anyway, it turned out that in the contract for Last Exit, there was a little thing at the bottom. The last part of the contract is usually that the publisher has first a refusal on the next man. But this also had something about an advance would be paid of such and such an amount. And I didn't know why not, I just signed it. But it turns out that that little thing makes it like a binding contract. And I would have to fight to have it published by somebody else. And I was given some, I think, inappropriate information. Anyway, at the time I owed the government money, and I was told that I could get a whole lot of money in advance on this book from somebody else because of the success of Las Vegas. And so I was upset about having to go with Grove, and most they would give me is $5,000. And by that time, you know, Grove had gone through its changes with the movie stuff and whatever that was all about, but Richard Siever was driving a cab. You know,
sure.
And yeah, that's what, you know, so things had changed. They didn't have, whatever, things had changed at Grove. And I was upset about it, and then I did a lot of praying over this thing, trying to figure out what, well, not figure out, but try to understand what was the appropriate action for me to take. Somebody, I was told that I could get a lawyer, and I could probably win in court. How long that would take. So and that, but what I finally realized, there's a whole...
This was all because you thought that the advance was too small in the real.
Yes, yeah, I was told that I could get like $50,000 from somebody else, as opposed to the $5,000 Grove wanted to pay me. I was also told I could go to court and break the contract. But then I finally realized that the only reason somebody else would pay me $50,000 for this book, if in fact they would, I don't really know that, but at the time I was told that and believed it. The only reason they would was because of the success of Last Exit. And the reason that Last Exit had become a commercial success was because of what Grove Press had done for me. So I had, for me, an obvious moral obligation to give them the book regardless of contract or anything else. And so that just resolved that problem and published the book.
And how did that do?
Well, it got the greatest reviews I've ever read in my life. And no one knows that it's been published to this day. It still sells in England, and a used copy sells for $75 if you got one. But it's also the most disturbing book I've ever read in my life. Jeez. Huh. To get writing now. That's how I come to realize, you know, my real obligation to Grove and what they did for me. I didn't
well,
really
there are a lot of,
see it before.
There are a lot of writers who have felt that. I mean, you're not the only one. I mean, that Grove had really gone to bat for them in the early years and have stayed with Barney because
it
of that.
It was Barney, but not
Grove. That's right. Not everyone has stayed. William Burroughs just got, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I guess, a really big contract to leave Grove,
really?
Like about a $5 million.
$5 million?
Yeah.
Well, from whom?
Well, from Viking Penguin.
Yeah?
For his next 5 books or... I don't know. Do you know this agent, Andrew Wiley? There was a profile in him in Vanity Fair a couple of months ago. But he's sort of come on the scene as a major wheeler dealer, the sort of agent that everybody hates. And he's been making these big deals for people. And he's the one who got Burroughs a big contract to Lee Grove. I mean, enormous contract.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But other people, I mean, obviously Beckett has had lots of offers to go elsewhere all along the way, and
mm-hmm.
has always turned them down.
Mm-hmm.
Partly out of his loyalty to Barney. And in fact, offered Barney, once Barney got ousted from Grove, offered Barney some material to start a new press.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Barney's contract with Weidenfeld was so bad that he couldn't do that.
Yeah, I know. How did Barney ever come to sign that?
I don't know. But he, I mean, whatever attorneys went over the contract ought to be shot. I mean, such a terrible contract. I mean, the one clause in it that says that he couldn't do anything to compete with Grove Press for something like 5 years after he left, or 10 years after he left.
Man, yeah. Okay, well.
I mean, he's tried to do little bits and things. You want to hear that?
They hung up.
Little bits and things. Published one or two little books, but only those things which Grove rejects. I mean, they've got him in a position now where if he wants to publish anything, he's got to first work as a sort of unpaid scout and editor for Grove, because he can only publish those things Grove rejects. Amazing. Let me get back to some of the reception of Last Exit. You alluded to this, the problems with the Provincetown review, and you made brief allusion to a debate in the House of Commons. What was that about?
The Provincetown review?
Well, no, you went through that,
yeah.
But the House of Commons.
Oh, well, there was as I remember this now, and of course I'm getting it second and third hand information, but at the time, and maybe it's still the case, anybody can bring suit against a book or a publisher if they find it offensive. And there was a member of Parliament, House of Commons, named Sir Cyril Black, who was the head of the Moral Rearmament Group or Society, whatever it's called. And he brought suit against the book. And it turns out that this man, and he's a millionaire actually, he believes in capital punishment. He believes in the birching of school children. He believes in public whipping. He does not believe in dancing, smoking, drinking, or makeup. And it turns out that he made his money as a slumlord. But he was morally indignant about this book. So they had this big debate in the House of Commons, if you can believe it, for 2 weeks. And it was brought to trial, and they had this trial. But out of it, something wonderful happened. Let me get the exact name. A group was... A group of artists. Artist Defense League or something like that was formed to raise money and so forth to defend the book. I'll get this for you later. But people like... Anthony Burgess and Beckett and so forth got together. And that organization is still in existence. And it started to defend this book, which is wonderful. And what happened was that the thing was finally resolved in favor of the publisher on a legal technicality. I mean, the book was never found non-pornographic or anything, but some legal technicality. The thing was finally thrown out of whatever their legal terminology is, and so the book was allowed to be published, and then they came out with this post-trial edition with an introduction by Anthony Burgess. So, you know, it had a marvelous history to the book. I mean, a lot of wonderful things have happened. So there's an organization now fighting censorship, artistic censorship.
And how did Calder, or then Calder and Boyer, publish it in England? And
mm-hmm.
How did they push the book?
I have
no
idea.
With them?
I have no idea what they did.
Well, how were they in this trial with the House of Commons?
I have no idea. I mean, they obviously must have organized the defense. But, you know, I wasn't there, and I would just get a letter occasionally saying this happened or that happened. So I don't know any of the details exactly how they brought that all about.
Were there other censorship problems in the States that you recall?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean,
certainly by 64, the major court battles.
Yeah, Lady Chatterley was over, Henry
so
Miller.
So that cleared the way.
Yeah. Now, there may have been some local things, some of the fundamentalists of those burning books.
Sure.
But I don't know that there was any real organized censorship problem. Some people found it offensive. Other than
sure.
that, I don't know. I don't think there was a big problem.
Well, certainly the story of Last Exit is a wonderful. I mean, not only the book, which actually was very formative in my own life. It's one of those books that got me interested in literature, and part of this whole Grove project is really a labor of love, because that was the period that I really became aware of literature. And certainly
mm-hmm.
Last Exit was one of those things, again, for me, too, that people can write about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Tralala, which just was the greatest story I'd ever read
at the people,
time. I mean,
a lot of people really respond to that.
Extraordinary. I just couldn't believe it. It
took me 2.5 years to write that.
To write that story, Sarah?
It was 20 pages long.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand it. Once I understood it. What it had to do with my whole aesthetic, actually. Once I understood what I had to do, then the thing just went like that.
How do you mean that it had to do with your whole aesthetic?
Well, I believe that the artist's primary responsibility is to get free of the human ego. I don't think the artist has the right to impose himself between the audience and the work, whatever the means. And I believe my responsibility is to the work. I mean, everybody has a million stories. What's the big deal? And if you just want to hear a great story, go to any street corner in New York. Go to a pool room, go to a candy store. You'll hear, or an all-night coffee shop, you'll hear stories knock your socks off with those guys, man. But for whatever reason, I had to do more than that. And I believe that these stories are given to me for whatever reason. And, you know, I don't know where they come from. It's like Einstein said, he had a... know where my understanding of the principle of the universe comes from. I just know they don't come from my rational mind. So these stories are given to me, and I believe it's up to me to understand the story and to meet the obligations of the story, to get to the essence of it, and then from that create a work of art. And I couldn't find that in Carlisle. That's why it took me 2.5 years. And then finally I realized what it was. Finally got there. The demand of this story was, I show the psychodynamics of an individual through the rhythms and tensions of a prose line. And once I understood that, then the story just came. Nothing, there's no work ethic. And it starts off with, you know, boom, 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 boom. The tension slowly comes out. So at the end, you know, it never ends, it just stops. It's like 2 or 3 pages long. So as she disintegrates, the line just kind of flops around. And of course, all that has to be organic with the events that the line is describing.
Mm-hmm.
So once I realized that, it took me 2.5 years to realize what my responsibility was.
You said earlier that you were reading all sorts of things that Sorrentino was suggesting, or at least following up on some of the names he was he was dropping.
Well, not just he, the conversation with other people.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Who else are you reading during this period?
Started reading, the first books I bought were Aristotle, Plato, and Marcus Aurelius in the hospital, a book club. Classics Club it was called. I think you got, for $1, you got those 3 books. I didn't know who they were. I read them. I didn't know what the hell I read, but I... Yeah. And then I would read Hemingway, Steinbeck, Céline, Despassos, Anatole France. I just, you know...
But with whom did you have the most sympathy during this period? Well, while you were working on Last Exit?
Oh, while I was working on Last Exit,
yeah.
I stopped reading while I was...
Oh, you did?
Okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I just didn't want to be influenced.
Sure.
While I was actually writing, I didn't read much.
Sure.
But one of the guys I really, rejoiced in was Saroyan. Crazy. You know, most of his stuff is what he calls spoofs. But even in the spoofs, there's some nice things. But boy, every now and then he came out with something that knocked his socks off. You know, that thing, one book of his, The Laughing Matter, and Rock Vagran, Human Comedy. But my idol, Isaac Babel, I carried a picture of Isaac around. Yeah, I've always had a picture of him in my pocket.
That's interesting.
I just finished rereading his stories.
Yeah?
Oh, God, just the fucking humanity, you know?
Yeah.
That stuff. And then Joyce. And as a matter of fact, the end of Dakota, The Last Exit, that thing called Land's End, that comes directly from James Joyce, the last line.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. There's a story of Joyce's in Dublin, and I can't remember the name of the story, but it's about this guy who goes out and has a couple of drinks at lunchtime, and he ends up, after work, getting drunk. And then he gets into an arm wrestling thing with a midget from the circus, and the midget beats him. And so he gets drunk and he comes home and starts beating the shit out of his little girls. And the end of the story is something like a little girl says, I'll say a Hail Mary for you, Father. I'll say a Hail Mary for you. And that line has always stuck in my head. And that's where the end of Land's End comes from. Jesus loves us.
Is it Little Something? Is the name of the story? Little somebody's name.
I don't know. See, all my books are back home in my mother's cellar, so I don't have it to look at.
Yeah.
And that's where the end of this Land's End comes from. So I usually have the last line written first before it's taught.
Is that right?
Yeah, in this book. And
so the whole book, not just
yeah, for each section.
Yeah.
So I knew what I was working towards. But I didn't have Abraham slip before I started, but then I realized that.
Right.
And when I came, oh, wow, so fucking lovely. The father of us all.
That's right.
In a deep nod.
Well, this is a very good story. The publication of both of them, The Room and Last Exit. The major project that I'm working on is this book-length study of growth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sort of intermediary step along the way. These people who put out, I'm sure you know this journal, the Review of Contemporary Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they did an issue on you, or at least part of
an issue.
Yeah,
that's Jack O'Brien.
Yeah, Jack O'Brien, right. They've asked me to do a Grove Press issue.
Oh, really? Oh, nice.
And that's something I can do, like, in the next 9 months or so, on the way to finishing up this book, which is going to take a long time, because there are just so many people to...
interview,
to talk to.
Right.
And it's wonderful because it's essentially a who's who of contemporary American art, or the contemporary international art, for that matter, at least that period from 52 to 86.
And so many of the American people he published are still doing strong in Europe.
Right.
That's where my biggest audience is.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they love me in Europe. It's just in this country that nobody knows I'm alive.
Right. That's such a familiar story. And you can't believe.
I know.
You know, well, there's a culture where people still read, but it's not here.
No.
Sure. At any rate, there's some question about how to put this issue together. Part of it should be a kind of tribute to Barney, without really being just everyone praising Barney. I mean, that'd get pretty boring. If everyone says the same thing, what a great person Barney is.
Yeah, I don't know if he was a great person. He might have been a motherfucker for
all I know. Well, there are some people who have that opinion of him for various reasons. Certainly people he got entangled with don't only have good things to say about him. And a good part of that issue will be perhaps some of these interviews that I'm doing. But I'd also like to get to convince some people who had published in those early years to do a little piece on, like, the shaping of Last Exit and how it got to Grove and the like. I don't know how busy your schedule is or
I don't imagine.
Yeah.
Also, I'll probably be back east all summer working on the film of Last Exit.
That's great that this is finally going to happen this time.
Well, listen, man.
You've had a number of false starts on this.
I know. Well, this is the first time anybody's ever attempted, you know, had the whole book. Actually, it's a small portion of the whole book. See, to try and get the whole book is craziness. But this is a real filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Who's doing it? Scorsese?
No. This is Bernd Eigner, the guy that did Das Boot.
Oh, yeah.
Name of the Rose.
Oh, yeah.
Christine F.
Oh, yeah.
Never Ending Story.
Yeah.
They're Germans.
And well, then it may get done.
Hmm?
Then it may get done.
Yeah, it may really get done.
So it's not a Hollywood finance project?
No. Well, I don't know about the finance.
Yeah.
That I don't know anything about.
Yeah. Are you doing the screenplay?
No. But I'll be working with him on the whole project.
So that's going to be shot this summer?
It's supposed to be shot. The tentative date as of now is the middle of June, which may mean like the beginning of July. I mean, you know, these days.
Sure.
But they've been working on the sets back in Brooklyn, you know, building the facades over there, and all that kind of stuff. And
where are they shooting it?
In Red Hook. Yeah, we can't use the actual location because the Army base closed quite a while ago. I mean, that was sort of shut down.
Which base? Fort Hamilton?
No, not Fort Hamilton, but the New York Port of Embarkation, 58th Street, 2nd Avenue.
Yeah.
It's now evidently a big office building, and there's all, you know, like thousands of cars in a parking lot.
Yeah.
And this movie takes place in 51, and it's pretty hard to get, you know, and it's all been painted. It just isn't available.
Sure.
So they're using another area that's very similar
as
far as the neighborhood goes, and then building.
I haven't been back in a long time. I grew up in Brooklyn.
Oh,
but,
yeah?
North Brooklyn. Green Park.
Uh-huh.
The Polish ghetto. About that time. That period. But at any rate, I'm sure you are very busy, but maybe you think about doing, start your autobiography. It might be nice to do this little piece.
I'm not really a couple of pages down.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, I think...
just pretty much of like what...
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think we would sort of prefer to get a lot of these people together who have... who have either been helped by Barney or whose major work has been published by Barney to do a little piece themselves in their own prose. So you get a lot of distinctive... styles rather than editing every...
of course, the great thing is it gives you a sense of what Barney published.
Rather than homogenizing everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll turn out academies.
If we can avoid that,
that would be better.
When would it be needed?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of putting this together over the next 9 or 10 months. So we've got
within a 9 or 10 months, I might be able to.
Sure.
I just really, you know, I've been working at a regular job for 2 years, which gave me no time to write. And I started a new book, a movie, time manager.
Sure.
And if I don't get to my book, my life isn't worth living.
I know.
But yeah, something like a couple of pages, that should be possible.
Right. I mean, it's something you can take in whatever direction you want. I mean, no matter how short it is, we could always put a little introduction into it again based on some of these tapes. I mean, take it in whatever direction you feel you want to write about. I mean, don't feel it, that you necessarily have to cover every historical incident.
No, I understand. I don't even know what the historical incidents are.
Right.
I have to let it just...
Well, that'd be great if you could do that.
Yeah. Well, I'll
because,
make a...
You know, McClure is doing, Michael McClure is doing a piece on Barney's producing the beard in New York. And again, I mean, that's the kind of thing we talked about, and I could do a sort of a bland historical version of that. But when Michael tells the story with Hell's Angels coming in and doing poetry readings before the production, this is when Barney's running the Evergreen Theater into his both film and theatrical production attempts, which all of which turned out to be a massive fiasco and lost lots and lots of money on that whole Evergreen Theater. But one of the high points was doing The Beard in New York, directed by Rip Torn and
That I didn't know.
Oh, yeah, so it's wild. So we can get, you know, some of these key books. And they're especially the books that when I talk to Barney and I say, you know, give me the 15 or so most important books that you've published. And certainly Last Exit is on that list. So if we can get those writers actually to do those pieces, I mean, it would be not only an interesting issue of the review, but I think a nice little tribute to Barney. Because not a lot of people have I'm surprised that not a lot has come out about this ousting and the like. And I think he needs something, some kind of recognition.
Oh, you know? Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Have you talked with Nat and Mort and those people yet?
Not yet. No, I've been contacting since I'm on the West Coast now.
Yeah.
I've been talking to as many people up and down the coast as I can. I should stop in New York a bit this summer, but mostly I'm going to be in Paris.
What a tragedy.
Yeah, no,
dirty
work. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
And talking to a lot of people there, not only the French group that he published, but there are a lot of translators and like there that are born.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Boy, you got a whole...
Right, right. So there are a lot of people to interview. So the issue of the review should come out a lot sooner than the book itself.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So keep that in the back of your mind.
Yeah, I will. I'll
I may drop you a note every once in a while just
fine.
To...
Yeah, I'll do the very best I can to
sure.
To do that. That shouldn't be
sure,
it.
Sure, however...
Must be some way I can squeeze that pocket.
Okay, that'd be nice. Great, well, this has been very helpful and very useful to me.
Oh, good.
If I have another couple of questions, could I either call or
sure.
stop by?
Yeah, either way.
I'm also annoyed that I did not bring, on purpose, my copy of Last Exit because it's only a torn up paperback. And I had expected to pick up a copy. Even this morning in one of the used bookstores, but evidently it's not so easy to get.
Especially since that Time magazine, LA Times thing came
out. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if the Last Exit had been available, I could have sold another 1,000 copies of the fucking thing.
That's right. That's incredible. It's not a print.
Yeah, and next month there's going to be somebody from the Village Voice coming out to interview.
Oh, great.
So,
well, I mean, Grove has enough of business savvy to know they better get some copies in print pretty quickly. You would think. Yeah.
I mean, then I can send that book.
Well, I mean, that's certainly not the kind of book that Weidenfeld has
made his
reputation.
I'm not familiar with his background. What is he?
Well, evidently he's Austrian, originally, and has moved to England during the... rise of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the family too well, but he got his start essentially publishing sort of coffee table books.
Mm-hmm.
And still does an awful lot of that. And evidently his specialty is like the Hollywood people producing or putting together packages. He's evidently very good at commissioning things, saying here's a kind of book that's needed and this is the right person to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And except that a lot of those books tend to be fairly sterile. evidently he's been very good at convincing people to back his enterprises, especially rich women. Was very good at that in London, and evidently now very good at that in this country, because he convinced Ann Getty to put up an awful lot of money to really launch his American enterprise. I mean, a couple of people have done it. I mean, John Calder has launched an American enterprise, but his is so tiny. you don't know that it exists. Well, Weidenfeld wanted to do things in a much splashier way.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Weidenfeld Nichols in this country, but it had no great standing here. So they targeted Grove, convinced Ann Getty to put up some money. She'd been a student in Berkeley in the 60s, thought she liked this. Literature, at least Grove, was the kind of stuff she was reading at the time, and is trying to be Jacqueline Onassis. Wants to move into to publishing, so bought herself and Lord Weidenfeld a little publishing house.
And now she wants to destroy it.
Well, that's what's been happening, I think. I'm afraid so. Plus the things that they're publishing. Well, I mean, they've had some good selling things. Arthur Miller's recent book has done really well for them. We've got two or three things that they're doing well, but nothing that has the kind of character that that Barney would publish. Obviously, they're not going to touch the sort of thing, you know, when Barney's son is in Nicaragua and comes up with the CIA's manual for how to disrupt government, sends it back to Barney, and Barney publishes it, much to the distress of the CIA. But Weinfeld is not going to publish anything like that. And despite the Gettys talking about not having any connections with the oil industry and about every other industry, I mean, they still have very strong sympathies there. I mean, they're simply not going to publish the kind of things that Barney...
No connection with the oil industry.
I know. I know.
That's pretty funny.
They've already turned down Genet's What Became His Posthumous book.
Really?
Because it's too pro-Palestinian.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that certainly wouldn't deter Barney. So, I mean, it's quite clear that the whole shape of the press has changed a good deal. It's getting more homogenized. I mean, part of Barney's problem with the press is that it couldn't work the way Weidenfeld wanted them to work. And that is to attend editorial meetings every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock. I mean, Barney works from his pool and from the tennis court and, you know, wherever he is. He's not exactly been a regular sort of bureaucratic publisher. And he just didn't fit into Weidenfeld's plan.
Well, it doesn't seem possible that Weidenfeld will ever plan to keep
him. I would guess so.
You know?
That's right. I mean, the stipulation in the contract was that Barney would stay editor-in-chief for between 5 and 10 years or at the discretion of the board of directors. And it's that second clause that Barney missed.
Somebody.
Yeah.
And so they set up their own board of directors. I mean,
right.
Obviously.
Right.
That's what you do. You get somebody fool enough to sign that contract.
Right. Well, Barney thought he had it all. He was getting money to recapitalize. Getting some pocket money.
Well, I would have to assume that there was a lot of verbal stuff going on. A lot of conversations that made it possible to delude oneself. And
miss the print.
Although I would think that he would have a disinterested lawyer going over to him.
I would have guessed. But evidently, not one sharp enough to warn him of the pitfalls of this. I mean, the contract is so bad. On his departure, Barney was also supposed to present to them a full Grove library, which never existed. I mean, Barney never systematically kept. I mean, he moved so often. And he just never systematically kept a copy of absolutely everything he did. So Barney was running around last summer in New York trying to buy up copies of things and use bookstores to fulfill that part of his contract. I mean, they really, about every way they could, they really shafted him.
It's amazing that his lawyer didn't.
And every little detail of his relationship with Grove has been terrible. I mean, Barney had this arrangement where he had that house on West Houston, and he had the penthouse, and rented everything else to Grove, drove a company car, all the standard sort of perks of a company president. Well, the first thing that Weidenfeld did when they bought the company was they were going to move it uptown, move it out of the village for one. That leaves Barney with this enormous house that he can't pay for. So he had to sell that. Wanted to buy this Toyota van that he had been using from them. The price they quoted was more than a new one. I mean, just right down the line, point by point by point. They grabbed him by the balls and they kept squeezing. So, it's not a good story.
Really gross. I mean,
yeah.
That's so unnecessary.
Well, you would think.
I don't understand why not just start your own press? Why destroy one?
I'm sure they didn't think they were doing that. What they were doing, essentially, was buying a backlist. And that backlist, as it turns out now, for what they paid for Grove, I mean, they essentially stole it. I mean, they essentially got the whole press with that backlist that'll go on for the next 100 years for probably around $3 million.
Jesus.
$2 million cash to Barney and paying off his debts to Random, which were pretty close to another million. So they put money back into the press, but that's all the straight money that they paid for a superb backlist. So, I mean, they got it for a peanut.
Holy mackerel.
So that's where Barney is, sort of floundering around. He says, had to move out of his place. Another
wife
left him.
They didn't go uptown anyway. Grove, they're right over on Broadway, downtown Broadway.
You may be right. I keep forgetting your address.
190 or something like that.
920.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. I haven't been to the New York office.
I haven't either, but I know, you know, like 1300, so it's around 34th Street.
Yeah, okay, so they're in it. Well, they're not in the village anymore, anyway.
No, they're north of the village. Yeah. They certainly aren't up that side.
Right, it's not too bad.
It's not a town.
Right.
I'd rather be in the village.
Well, it's like Barney had there once, on West Ham.
Just
beautiful place.
Ripped his ass, huh?
Yeah, I did. Well, thanks very much. For all this, as I said, I hope I can stop by sometime. If I I'm a little saddened by leaving.